Inside Sports Dead in Goal podcast for another week. I'm James Smith and this is Jeff Centenary joining me. How are you going, Jeff?
I'm very well.
Yes.
Finished a magazine, always, yeah, always good.
And now you're going to be talking about more words.
Yes. Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. What number is this, James?
This is 66.
66?
Yes, we've got the statisticians on the job. Now we're right online. So we're going to get very literary today. It's a bit of a special edition, seeing as though the season's over.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, there is no off-season.
There is no off-season. But seeing as how they're not regular matches being played, yeah, time to pick up a book.
That's right.
To pick up a book, audience. Stop listening to podcasts. Oops, sorry. Pick up a book. Up a book and listen to podcasts.
That's what we should do. Audiobooks. Rugby league audiobooks.
Rugby league audiobooks.
Wow.
Read by Tommy Radonicus.
And Thomas Keneally. So this week we're going to be talking about yours and ours, our all-time favourite rugby league books. I sent out a Twitter question this week, which was, what are your favourite rugby league books? And I got an absolutely overwhelming response. It was amazing. I couldn't include everybody's answers in our section that we'll have later on, because a lot of people just responded with the book covers.
Mm.
So, yeah, it didn't really translate into me reading them out. So, but yeah, thanks so much again for all the fun that everybody had with this. It was fantastic. So a special treat this week. I caught up with, I don't know whether you're familiar with the name Alan Whittaker.
I am.
Has he come across? Yeah. Yep. He's a god, because he put out the Rugby League Encyclopedia, which back in the day was basically proof that you played rugby league.
Mm. You're obsessed with this book, aren't you?
I get told a lot, you go to barbecues and dinners, and my uncle Jock Hughes played for this club back in 1965. Mm. Did he really? Oh, yeah. Right. And then you store it in your head and then you go back.
Paul home. Kent must walk around with one of these on him, right?
Yeah, he's in there. the co-author of that book, the Rugby League Encyclopedia of Players, or the other way around. So he co-authored that with Alan Whittaker. He wrote a lot of the bios that are in the book.
Alan Whittaker co-authored it with Alan Whittaker.
Alan Whittaker co-authored with Glenn Hudson, who he talks about. And I had a real honour of catching up with Alan for an interview, which is going to be at the back of this podcast. So, yeah, thought it'd be good to have a bit of a star author in the edition.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. We're going to basically talk about rugby league words and books and stuff. What's been happening with you besides getting cricket guides
yes,
out?
Yes, way too much cricket already.
The
most league thing I did kind of in the past week is for unconnected reasons, caught up with the Seoul Roosters fan, basically, in my life.
Booth Hound to be loving this.
So in my social circles. Yeah. And you know he was actually wearing kind of like a Roosters jacket to this social engagement in Newtown that we were attending, and he's not a fake. He actually grew up what's the area? I guess Little Bay,
Bay.
Yeah, yeah.
That'd be down in South Territory.
Is that South Territory, or is that technically still?
It's down towards La Perouse, isn't it?
Yeah,
but I'll give it to him at least.
I thought that's east. It's still eastern suburbs.
Little Bay, I'm sure.
Because
that's Maroubra and Matraville and all those.
I thought Matraville was east. They often say, Dave Warner is from that territory, right? And he's a Roosters fan as well.
Fair enough.
Okay, if you want to accept that's a grey area, he is kind of from around, I guess you could call it Roosters territory. Like, it's not unusual for a Roosters fan.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's no fake. So he was suitably chuffed about the Premiership victory. Wasn't. Yeah, supremely confident coming into the game, and I think he was surprised at how well they did. But it was kind of weird. The thing that kind of got him really exercised more than anything else was more than even like kind of getting an emotional reaction of the victory, was Cameron Munster's behavior during the match. He kept on saying, he kept on insisting that Cameron Munster should never play rugby league again. mainly because, particularly because of the kicking the guy kind of, who did he, I can't even remember who he kicked in the head.
Yeah.
Towards the end of the match. Just, it was just so kind of worked up about how grubby kind of Munster was. So, yeah, and I think you kind of remarked to me, and I think quite rightly, that's weird. You just won the premiership in a very dominant, you know, fashion. You know, no questions asked.
Yeah.
But yeah, the thing he was fixated on was Munster's behaviour on the field. So funny, isn't it? You know, it really is.
Like, I can't remember. I mean, I'm not a South fan, but do South fans remember how Burgess hurt his
broke his face?
Yeah,
I actually do.
Okay.
That was, and it wasn't,
but it wouldn't be a dominant memory of that win for South fans.
It wasn't an act of robbery really either. It was just a hard hit. It was a hard impact hit where, you know, kind of, yeah, like I think somebody's shoulder, or I think it might have even been a head to face contact.
Might have been friendly fire, maybe. But yeah, it's a funny take, isn't it? Funny.
Mm.
Not satisfied with the...
Yeah. But the other thing he was carrying on about was whether Billy should have been allowed to play or not. But, you know, kind of was able to talk him back to the point that, yeah, for Roosters fans, you wanted Slater to play so that the Storm would have no excuses.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, if they lost. And that's basically how it played out.
Yeah, and that's what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about you, James?
You're
in off-season, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. but I like this part of the year because there's so much still happening, as discussed last week.
Mm-hmm.
But I cannot for the life of me think of anything rugby league-ish that I did in the last week. It's amazing.
Detox.
Yeah.
Even think about rugby league, ladies and gentlemen.
I did, unfortunately.
Oh, God.
That event that we were talking about last week, the Emerging Nations World Cup.
Yes.
Couldn't handle it, had to follow the results, hadn't heard of any players in, had to go and see how Poland and Japan were going.
That's right.
You just, it gets to you, doesn't it? Yeah, you do get withdrawal symptoms, so, and that probably leads us to what we were most looking forward to, doesn't it?
Yes, I think we got the same thing. You actually are going to be in attendance.
I'm jetting off to New Zealand to watch Australia and New Zealand at Auckland. I haven't been to New Zealand before, so really looking forward to it. Yeah,
that'd be a good way to kind of take it in for the first time.
Yeah, about the only thing retro I can link it back to was the last time I was overseas watching football was Australia versus New Zealand at the World Cup final back in 2000.
Oh wow,
it was at Old Trafford. So yeah, a bit of deja vu here, but I'm really looking forward to the game. I think the Kiwis, I think they're more evenly matched than they have been for the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, I think last year
is that because dominant side is that because this is not exactly a first choice Australian side.
I think so. But and the Kiwis, they have every right to start their campaign with a big performance, because after this game they head north to play England for three tests.
Yep.
So it's a big time of year, a lot of national pride for the Kiwis. And I haven't been to that. Oh, of course I haven't been to New Zealand, so goes without saying. I haven't been to Mount Smart Stadium, so I've only seen that on television. I'm really looking forward to.
It'd be interesting if you went to Mount Smart Stadium but never been to New Zealand.
helicopter you out after full time and straight to the airport.
I'm looking forward to how this Kiwi side kind of gets itself back on track.
Oh, yeah.
Like, after kind of really what was a disastrous World Cup kind of performance last year.
Was it a disaster losing to Tonga, who were absolutely like a juggernaut? They still would have been embarrassed by that loss, wouldn't they?
Not the loss in and of itself. I think just the way they kind of, you know, kind of performed the tournament was not really up to kind of the way they'd want to have performed.
They were the wowsers of the World Cup, weren't they?
Mm.
If there were so many good stories, that comes at a cost to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And it came at a cost to the Kiwis, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, somebody had to pay, didn't they? Yeah. Anything? Like, where do you think the Kiwis can get them? Do you think if they do have a chance of redemption?
Well, as you pointed out, I mean, I think they're a very good pack.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing that kind of I kept on remarking upon, kind of in the run in towards the end of this year. I really like the look of Jobson Manu. I thought he's a fantastic player. And
ended the season really well.
Yeah, it could be one of those things where maybe this is just a really good run of form for him at the right time of year to have it. But plainly has the potential to be a very, very good player into the future. And he kind of be in the centres for New Zealand. Let's see if he can kind of be a critical piece for them kind of going forward.
No, fantastic. Yeah, it should be awesome. It's a great representative period coming up. Plus, we've got the Super League Grand Final this weekend. So, yeah, it's it hasn't stopped yet, the rugby league circus. One thing, seeing as that this is a literary themed podcast, you've actually spoken to more league centric and football centric authors in the last little while than me.
Mm-hmm.
And you had, for example, you caught up with Mazcord was that about a year ago?
About a year ago, yeah.
Yeah, leading into the World Cup when he was working for us for a little bit.
Yep.
What, and you've also spoken to George Megalogenis, who has a new book out more on the social fabric of Australia and football clubs related to all that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything you picked up while you were talking to those two guys as to why they were doing this? Like why footy and it's interesting that those two blokes.
Yeah.
Have done stuff like this, isn't it?
Yeah, for Steve, it was more of, I think, well, actually, even for both, I think it's a very personal project.
Yeah, there you go.
You know,
yeah.
in many respects, I guess, a lot of, there's a lot of kind of self-expression that comes out kind of in your fandom, and that might be a fandom not just for maybe a footy club, but for footy in general. Like, I can't speak to, with Mascord, I mean, I guess he back in the days with Illawarra, growing up as an Illawarra fan, but now it's more about the game. Whereas as you know, George, he's mad Richmond in that other code down there. But a guy who's also got an abiding interest, I think, in league, particularly in the way league explains the difference in the culture of New South Wales and Queensland as opposed to, Aussie rules down in the southern states.
Yep.
So, I mean, that's one thing I could really commend. I mean, if you have an interest, in that other code, George's book, The Football Solution, is probably is a really kind of good, I guess what you'd call interrogation of the whole Barassi, kind of the differences across the Barassi line, what's called the Barassi line, the thing that separates the territory of the country into its, into its rugby league constituent, its Aussie rules contingent. So in a lot of respects, there's a bit of personal expression that comes through as well, but it's also just a very kind of useful way of explaining Australia, I say. There's a lot of that came out kind of through both books, different in a certain way. Like Steve's is very much kind of an expression of, I was only thinking about this the other day when he talked about how, like, the other kind of essential element of that book is rock and roll music, particularly kind of the hair metal of the 80s, which is his other abiding passion. And the words he used was that for him, for a kid kind of growing up, kind of, down Wollongong way, for him, like, rugby league and rock and roll were naive expressions of glamour. He used a wonderful term, naive expressions of glamour for a kid growing up down there. Yeah, so, whereas when you look at George's book, that's more to do with politics.
Yeah,
so, that's, kind of different dualities there, but
you like interviewing authors, don't you?
You
do it for that regular segment that we have in our magazine.
It's
interesting.
Yeah, because plainly that they've had to think very deeply about their subject, and it's just kind of a way to to encapsulate. You can either read a lot of words, you can read the book itself, which is the best way to kind of get an understanding for what they're trying to say. But it's also kind of interesting to kind of understand where it comes from, what drove them to write the book in the first place. The circumstances under which kind of the idea coalesces. I guess one thing in the end I respect is that, it's very true. And our old boss here at the magazine, Graham Sims, made the point that, you really got to be obsessed with a topic to write a book. If you're not obsessed with it, don't try and write it. Because, he said the whole process will come to consume your life. And Graham, of course, wrote a very fine book on the Australian kind of athletics coach, Percy Serity. He was Herb Elliott's coach. And I think that's very true. And in that light, that level of obsessiveness, the level of obsession, is always just an interesting thing to try to tease out, I find. So it's that's why I kind of I like to include the stories of these authors in the magazine.
Yeah.
I think it's something that I think our readers of the magazine can kind of, over and above the fact too that. you know, if you're reading kind of our magazine, I think you probably would be the type would try to read, would like to read sports related titles.
Excellent. Yeah, so I might get to our podcast answers. What do you reckon?
I have one question before we get to this. What is your favorite kind of all-time rugby league book? Because I'll cop to it here. I haven't read deeply enough, I reckon, into the canon of league books. So yeah, it's I'm interested, and I'm actually looking forward to these answers, to try and get some guidance. What kind of got me thinking down this path is I interviewed Andrew Webster most recently.
That's another one. Sorry, Andrew, I forgot to mention
you. Andrew Webster most recently for actually that got me to thinking. I have read kind of. I was telling you I hadn't read enough. I have read at least one. More than at least one, but. And I'll bring put that forward right now. Webby's book on Jack Gibson
is
very good, super coach. Oh, so okay. I read that. That was I can commend that.
Yeah.
But Webby had a very nice little tale that the thing that made him want to become a sports writer, which of course included a stint at this fine magazine as a staff writer and some wonderful work he did for Inside Sport, was reading as a younger bloke King Wally. Yeah. By Adrian McGregor.
It's a good book, that
one. Yeah.
Yeah. I've never seen a bloke write in another person's voice as good as Adrian did there.
Mm.
Really good. It was written just after the Broncos came in, so all the pictures are all of the brand new Powers bit of jersey
from
1988 and all that sort of thing. Yeah, it's a great title, that one.
Mm-hmm.
What were you going to ask me before?
What was your favourite rugby league book?
Oh, okay. I've got it here for inspiration.
Right in front of us.
We cheated a little bit, but
audience is waving this book at me.
I love
not
it.
Understanding that this, podcasts are not a visual medium. Like he thinks that you can probably see, in this pod. Maybe we'll get an animation done up after the fact of
like they do. Super League, The Inside Story by Mike Coleman changed my life when I read it.
There you go.
Yeah, it was. I've never read a book that put you inside the room of each scene like this does. And every time you mention this book, it always it creates debate. Obviously a News Limited one-sided story, blah blah blah. I think that's an important part of the book, because I don't think it would be possible to write a story related to the Super League war if it didn't come from either side.
Mm.
It wasn't a neutral war. It was one side or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And the meetings that went on back then were very dramatic and they were very ruthless and cutthroat. And I thought Mike Cohen did a terrific job. And I've read it three or four times. And it's a narrative the narratives that go all the way through it. It's amazing. And just there's some pictures in there as well of the original press conferences and all the Star League and all the and all the the logos that Super League had to draw up really quickly so that they could hold press conferences about it. It all happened 20 years ago very quickly on the run, but left such an impression on the game, didn't it?
So, does it include my favourite Super League story?
When
Fatty Wharton told Piers Ackerman to shut up at the press conference?
Yeah, I'm sure it does. Yeah. I'm sure it does. Yeah. That's great, isn't it?
Footy show, and the finest thing Fatty ever did.
Bring out the DVDs of the footy show.
Meaning not the footy, not the footy show. I'm talking about telling Piers Ackerman to shut up.
That was a great moment, wasn't it?
That was a fantastic moment.
Yeah, yeah. That was a ARL versus New Zealand moment. it was the embodiment of the game. Yeah. Yeah, so that's my favourite one. As I'll gush later on in the interview with Alan Whittaker, the encyclopedia of rugby league players is something that'll go to the grave with me, I think. So yeah, love it. The one thing in these, so I put out a Twitter question related to all this is, and that was, what is your all-time favourite rugby league book and why? And it was a really good question for people to answer with, because everybody has these books in their bookshelves.
Mm.
It's sort of like, they're like proof that you're a rugby league nerd.
Mm.
It's like, you can only tell people how passionate you are about the Roosters or South or whatever. But yeah, this the responses gave people a real opportunity to go to their bookshelves and take pictures of their book covers and tweet them out, and it got a really good response, and there was a lot of good discussion. You know, someone would post out a book cover and other people would respond, oh yeah, I've got that one. Yeah, it was just a really fun experience. So should I go through a few of our readers' answers? So Mike M says Bill Harrigan's autobiography and Tyrell Nicow's book as well. So it's one name I didn't expect to come up. As I say, this isn't everybody's answers. A lot of people just responded with pictures of book covers. But this is basically a selection of them. Daniel Watson Hayes offers up Mike Coleman's Super League book. So at least I'm not the only one.
There you go.
Stuart McLennan says, "This Sporting Life by David Story captures how the game of rugby league was and still is. Gritty and tough, set in the heartlands of Northern England. It was the basis of the film of the same name, starring Richard Harris."
There are some film critics who would contend that This Sporting Life is the best film ever made about sport.
Wow, yes. There you go. Stuart's onto it.
Yeah, This Sporting Life is a wonderful film.
Oh, terrific.
Actually wasn't aware of the source material.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Oh. So you listen to this to learn, don't you?
I do it to kill time, but you know.
Yeah. Ross Martin says, "Men in Black" by Larry Reiter and Gary Lester. On a tangent, I also enjoyed the old Rugby League Week magazines in the days of Jeff Printer and Ian Heads. Mm. So Men in Black's about the history of the Penrith Panthers. Eel Backer says, has anyone read The Rugby Rebellion by Sean Fagan? Good insight into the game's beginnings. We reference that every now and then.
Yeah, we do, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's another one I've read.
Yeah, that's right. You're basically a gorger of league literature, mate.
Not quite, but there's more than, you know, I was trying to remember them offhand. I mean, I've got a lot of sports books in my brain.
Alex Carter says, 5-star brandy. I swear this isn't a Penrith podcast, this one, is it?
Yeah, right. Everyone's muttering under their breaths in the audience.
When's the sales part come? Yeah, 5-star brandy, as it was my favourite child, as he was my favourite childhood player. But I hate that it was written before the 91 grand final. I liked MG's book too, as it gave a kid from Bathurst an inside look at the league world. Here we go. I want you to read this out because you're better with French names. You're better than me. I'll mess this up.
Rugby à 13 hipster. Rugby a 13 hipster.
Yeah.
You want to, like, you know. I'll read this. "Definitely The Forbidden Game by Mike Rylance. Reading that book set me on the path to becoming an ardent treziste."
Beautiful.
Treziste. Not treziste. Treziste would be like an Italian pronunciation. I still think, and I think you made the point as well, that rugby league went down a historic wrong path by not calling itself 13.
I still don't think it's too late to change the name of the sport. I'd love it for to be called something
else. We're 110 years down the line. It's not too late to change.
Next week's podcast question: What should rugby league be called?
This should be part of our speculations podcast down the line,
which is coming.
Should we change? Yes, yes. We will tease that to the audience now. We're coming up with a pod where James and I are just going to lob ridiculous questions at each other. and this one, I think, is going to kind of make the cut.
I do owe you some, so yeah. You're always firing them at me. I've got to think up some brain benders for you. Should I keep going?
Yes.
Mark says that he really enjoyed Champagne Rugby, brought to life the French tours of Australia of 1951, 55 and 60.
Hmm.
So that's some really intellectual stuff right there. Legends of Sport says Andrew Johns's was a good book. I was working at a place and had to do some filing. I took the filing upstairs at 9 a.m, read Joey's book for 3.5 hours, then came back downstairs and went to lunch. Top book. Top day at work too.
I'm confused. Did John's book have advice about how to do filing?
My good mate Caddo helped him write that one, so I'll ask him. Gavin says, My fave is always the last one I read, the Forbidden Game by Mike Rylance, was it? Yeah. It covers the birth of rugby league in pre-war France, its rise in popularity, and its disgraceful treatment by the Nazi puppet government and their rugby union mates during World War II.
I don't know the book specifically, but you know, having learned about that story as we were doing some World Cup related stuff in last year, it is amazing. It's amazing how the game basically got oppressed.
Yeah.
And it got tied up in all those kind of political currents in France.
We should have a closer look at that one, because that's two people that have
yes.
suggested that one.
Or the same person using two Twitter handles.
Yeah. Chris B says, Stuff You May Have Missed, Vossi's book, and Touchstones.
Yes, indeed. Excellent. A couple of the more recent entries, yeah.
Yeah, they didn't all have to be 1980s retro, yeah. The Cumberland Throw says, How lame am I if I say Ray Warren's autobiography? You're not.
Is that an audiobook? And if it's not read by rabbits, it'd be pretty disappointing, wouldn't it?
That'd be awesome.
Mm.
Geez, that's a good idea. Rab's reading it out his own book. That's gold. Ilbacker again.
Loves his books.
Yeah. I enjoyed Jack Gibson's story and Arthur Beetson's.
Is that Gibson's own book, or is he talking about Webby's one? Who knows?
I don't know. I don't know how Ilbacker got in there twice. The big crisis going on out there at the moment.
Maybe there's just two guys called
that. Dog and Under says, I can't go past the good old rugby league yearbooks. As a kid, I pored over them. Just love looking back at ladders, stats, and trends from seasons gone by. I think he's talking about Middo's annuals.
Yeah.
Love them too. Toddy Goodwin says, not necessarily the greatest book ever written, but definitely a favourite. Local Hero, a Wayne Pearce story by Ian Heads, and The Great Heist by Ian Heads. Just classics there. What a legend. Doing at It All Day, Sir. Says, Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright, or Doing My Block. Great. I Am a Clown offers up Rugby League Through the Decades by Ian Collis and Alan Whittaker. Mr. Ives comes in with Good as Gould. So many insights and stories from Gus as a player coach about the Super League and Origin. So if there's a news ARL version of the inside story, it'd be Good as Gould, I reckon. Yeah, a lot of people suggest that. Mr. Barge Oz, or Mr. Barge Ass, says 28 Heroes about the 1990 Kangaroos tour. Great picks and a bit of behind the scenes stuff. Got under the skin of a young Bargy before you could look anything up on the internet.
That's not the one with the demolition derby.
I think it is. Oh. Yeah, that's the one.
As I was saying earlier, it's still my favourite rugby league story.
And what do we decide on? So just say the Aussies are over in New Zealand for 2 weeks. They've all got to go out and buy bomb cars. What are they getting? What's the modern version of that?
I don't want to alienate any potential automotive sponsors.
Hyundai XL, do you reckon that?
I like Hyundai. I drive Hyundai. There goes half the audience.
There goes half the podcast hosts. Bretto says The Great Grand Final Heist by Ian Heads. So it's another one that's got a few mentions. Media Watch Mario. Honestly, I've only read 10 or so, but Bush to Brookvale by Cliffy Lyons was a standout, probably just because I love him so much. Brilliant. And Courtney McShane says, I'd have to say Vossi's Stuff You May Have Missed. I'm not a big reader, but thoroughly enjoyed Vossi's book. I've started a few other league books, but haven't ever finished them. That's like me. I've started about 20 or 30, and yeah, when it gets up to... When they reach the part where everything starts going good, then that's when you sort of drift away. It's the hard luck stories that I like anyway.
So you never really started Brad Fittler's book?
Mate, I've never read it. I worshipped him as a kid.
Because Brad kind of woke up, everything was good. It's remained good until this day.
Yeah, yeah. He said a while back he couldn't believe the last time he was sad. It's like, oh, well, not reading that book. I want things to be dismal and...
Oh, my God.
Times to be tough. Yeah.
I was born and I was already the best rugby league player among, kids that were a minute old. And I felt pretty great about that.
You know what I mean, though? It's like songs. All the great songs are about heartbreak and
of course,
and, yeah,
of course,
about your life being destroyed and all that sort of thing. Same with sports books. So if I'm going to write a sports book, it's going to be hard luck story.
Is this where we go on our screed about how, you know, there's been a paucity of good kind of rugby, well, not even good, of rugby league books in general?
It really has, hasn't it?
You know, one of the things that I kind of remark upon, because it's one of the things that kind of one of the great things about being at the magazine is we're really kind of a clearinghouse for almost all the sport related kind of books that come, that get kind of published in any given year.
Yeah.
And one thing that's really kind of become noticeable in the last few years is that, you know, there is any number of BKG titles that come out. It's just ridiculous.
Every player writes one.
Exactly. And honestly, if it weren't for kind of the whole phenomenon of the retiring great kind of puts out a book in what is sure to be there, you know, last year.
Yeah.
If it weren't for that, there would not be a lot of, and like with another big title is actually just about to hit the market in the next week or so. It's Jonathan Thurston's book.
Yeah.
If it weren't for that, there would be very, very few kind of rugby league related books coming through at all.
That's right. You know, and I don't know why that is. Mm. Is it? I asked Alan in this interview coming up. Maybe just the characters don't exist anymore. Or don't know.
There's a bit of that too. But you know, like in my usual things when I stand up to pontificate it about, you know, like 4:45, so I don't have to do any more work for the day.
He does.
And like I kind of start screaming over at you, the partition. I made the point the other day that I'm of the conviction that the best story to be told in the last kind of decade, to couple of decades in Australian sport would be Souths.
Mm.
Like from out of the competition to, you know, that ending that premiership drought of theirs in 2014. That's an epic tale.
So it hasn't been told? Are you sure it hasn't been told?
Well,
it's a genuine question.
I know Michael Maguire wrote a book.
Yep.
But, you know, I can't understand why somebody out there wouldn't want to tackle that in huge kind of big narrative form.
So do you mean not that you've read it, but
in the
style of the inside story of Super League?
In the style of any book.
You want the inside story of South?
I guess every story, book story you'd hope is an inside story, but I just think that, you know, like for example, one book that we kind of look very favorably upon was the cricket writer Daniel Bredig's book, Whitewash to Whitewash, when he told this story, about, when was that? Was that about the 2005? Ashes to about the, I can't get the dates right, but it was telling the story of the Australian side as it transitioned out of the era of Ponting and Warren and McGrath and the Wars, and from one whitewash to that other Ashes whitewash, not the last one, but the one before, wasn't a whitewash, but the one before that under Michael Clarke. That was fantastic. That was a really, really well-told tale. I can't understand why, you know, that, you know, if there's some enterprising kind of league writer out there, why you wouldn't want to tackle the subject of a club that was literally kicked out of the competition, you know, a beloved foundational club, one that was, you know, iconic, and then to tell their story of finally getting back into the competition and then kind of ending so many decades of heartbreak. And when you consider that this is a tale that's populated with people that include a full-on world-famous movie star, one of the greatest players of his generation, and associated kind of other kind of, you know, very interesting, and, you know, a guy who got them back into the competition and then probably was deemed, you know, kind of, you know, not useful to the club anymore.
Yeah,
that's, I just think it's just laying there. And then, you know, having gone on this diatribe, ladies and gentlemen, James challenged me to write the book, and I was like, "Nah, not interested." My response was not interested in it. And then James just laughed at me for the next, you know, half hour.
You were complaining that it hadn't been written.
Mm.
You're a writer.
Mm.
We've reached that age.
I don't want to do the work. I want somebody else to do the work for me.
Just before we head into this Alan Whittaker interview, you know what book I want to read but don't want to write? The inside story of the Cooper Cronk Cameron Smith feud.
Oh god,
that would just be epic. That would be a page.
Isn't that like, you know, like just a really small book? is it true? Is it really such a thing?
I think so.
Yeah. It's not like, you know, it's not a book like, you know, English German humor, English cuisine and Italian war heroes.
Maybe that would be the way to do it. Make it a humor book. Like, who cares what the real story is? Make one up. and do it that way.
Aren't Smith and Cronk waiting for, you know? Isn't this kind of the thing that you're always complaining about with our cricketers, where, you know, our cricketers basically reach the end of their career. They finally put out a book and then use it to settle scores with all the people who have wronged them during their career. Yeah, our cricketers are such prima donnas.
Yeah.
It's not in the nature of leagueies to do that, because you know why? Leagueies get to hit each other.
If you've got
frustration against another block, you know, out there on the field, you go up and hit him.
You do.
And then by the end of your career, you've expended all that energy, and it's like, all right, I have no reason to, you know, kind of, you know, tear him a new one in a book.
And you're having
cricketers. Cricketers, on the other hand, they have to, because they can't hit other cricketers.
That's true, you know. Yeah,
that's my theory.
Yeah. My best part of that whole cricket ashes to ashes thingy that you were talking about before was the boat scene where they're celebrating.
Here we go. We're talking about rugby league books, and we end up talking about a cricket book.
We promise we'll get to this interview shortly.
Listen, I don't know. Obviously, they're saving it for their book, and you know they kind of use it to gin up the sales of their book. What I actually really felt about this guy, and then they can say it's amazing that we won like 3 premierships, 4 premierships together when we didn't even like each other. So there we go.
And that's fascinating. Yeah,
that'll be the marketing tagline for the book.
But you're right, they're each going to devote several chapters, their own books to it, for sure.
Mm.
Okay, so we'll move on to this interview with Alan Whittaker. Thanks very much for listening, and we hope you enjoy this interview of a true rugby league legendary author. We'll catch you next time.
See ya.
So, Alan Whittaker, thanks very much for being a guest on this week's Dead in Goal podcast.
Nice to talk to you, James.
Oh, it's an absolute honour. As I said, you're the first author we've had on this podcast, and it's such an honour to speak to somebody who's been around not only rugby league but rugby league, you know, writing for so long. You might not know it, or maybe you do, but you're a household name, and your name is on the shelves of a lot of rugby league wannabe historians like myself and rugby league nerds. So, yeah, how does that make you feel that you're a rock star?
Well, it's good. It's good to know that 30 years after I first got published, that people are reading my stuff and people have kept my stuff. And I've had a bit of feedback over the years about people who've read a few of my books. So it is always heartening when you hear those things. Yeah. It seems like a lifetime ago in the 80s, because in the early 80s, there was nothing being published on rugby league, and it wasn't until probably about 85, 86 that there started to be a little bit of a dribble from Gary Lester and Ian Heads, Norm Tasker.
Yeah.
And I was very lucky that I was probably young and naive, and I just jumped straight on board. And, you know, I always wanted to write, and having lived and grown up in Penrith all my life, the one thing I knew about was the Panthers, and it just seemed at that time that they were doing very well in rugby league. Greg Alexander had come in. Roy Simmons had just played for Australia. So there's a lot of positivity and energy around Penrith. So I just jumped on board, and here I am 30 years later still writing about rugby league.
No, terrific. I'm glad you talked about that 1980s era, because it's something that Jeff and I were touching on in the podcast just in the first half of the podcast just then. And I've always wondered whether or not it's just me wearing rose-coloured glasses about that era, because that's when I grew up watching rugby league, or whether there actually was a boom in rugby league book publishing back in the late 80s and early 90s. So there definitely was there?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. A lovely guy called Greg Anderson and I, who had gone to college together and we taught together, you know, we were looking for a project, you know, something to do at nights. You know, this is before we had kids and we were just newly married, and you know, we were very enthusiastic rugby league fans, but there was nothing being published. So we wanted to write the Penrith story, you know, the first 20 years of the club. So we investigated a couple of people. You know, Ian Heads had just published a book on South Sydney, where he'd done a year-by-year analysis. And it was very, and I met Ian years later, and he said, you know, it was a very poorly put together, almost scrapbook, you know, standard publication, but it sort of opened the flood doors. The first bio that I think I can remember, I remember Steve Mortimer had done Top Dog in about 85.
Yeah, we're getting there. Yep.
Yeah, and Sturlo did one in 88, 89, which is more my era, but there just wasn't anything being published. So we went to the club, we went to the Penrith Leagues Club, and we said, look, you know, we're two young guys, we'd like to publish the history of the Penrith Panthers. And they said, you know, we had the big meeting with Roger Cowan and the board, and they said, oh, that's wonderful, fellas, yep, good luck. You know, no offer, no help, no nothing. No money. They refused to put any money into it. So we had to go out and find a publisher, and it was just a magazine publisher that we found, and I did a book. We started with the Panthers, and then they were so happy with it, they said, you know, can you do one on Balmain? So I did a little magazine on Balmain. Some of your audience might remember Keith Barnes is on the front cover, and it's just a little magazine of each year. The good thing about Balmain is that they had an 80-year history at that stage, so it was quite involved. Yeah. And then Greg and I did North Sydney together, so we did exactly the same. Ken Irvine's on the front cover. So we did these two little magazines. They did okay. They did maybe 2,000 or 3,000 copies, nothing spectacular. But the irony is we never got the Penrith one published because it fell apart and the club wouldn't back it, and we had to wait for that one. So that's how we got started, and that's how difficult it was to find a publisher. No mainstream publishers, no Pam McMillan, no Random House, no Allen and Unwin were publishing rugby league at that stage, and we really had to get in through the back door and almost start the industry. But thank goodness, two journos, Gary Lester, who's a lovely guy, and Ian Heads, who everybody would know, they started a company called Lester Townsend Publishing. And Gary Lester's history of rugby league, Australian rugby league, came out in 1988 in time for the bicentenary. That's still one of the best books ever written on rugby league. And I remember lining up to get the book. I was waiting for the bookshop to open. We were so excited that, you know, a legitimate hard cover, classy book was being written about rugby league. It was really the start of a new era. And I can still look back on that and see that not only was at the start of an era, but I was sort of just a little bit behind the scenes, a couple of steps behind, coming through with my publications. So that gives me a lot of enjoyment now, looking back.
Oh, that's great. I was actually going, my next question was actually going to be what books of the era can you remember? And any others? Any others over the years that really majored, you know, that really drew you in and sort of...
Well, I remember Mal Meninga was such a huge figure in rugby league in 1991, and I got asked to do a biography of a publisher called Gary Allen, who was a book distributor, and he cut out the middleman and published his own books every now and then. I'd sent him a manuscript. It took me about 3 years to write it, but I did a history of grand finals, and I sent it to Gary, and he said, look, I'd really like to publish it. And he actually got Gary Lester to lay out the book. So I was sort of in that groove then after that. But Gary Allen asked me, oh, you want to do a biography? And I said, well, yeah, I do. I'd love to do a biography. Who do you want? He said, well, you choose. And that stage, there was only really two players I was interested in. One was Des Hasler, who I'd gone to school with. Des is a couple of years younger than me. He'd gone to school at Penrith, St. Dominic's boy. And I knew his family very well. I knew he had a really good story. But the other guy was Terry Lamb, so I just rang Terry Lamb up. Terry Lamb was in the book, you know, the Bulldogs legend. He was in the phone book, and I just rang him up and said, look, Terry, would you like to work with me on doing your biography? And he said, yeah, come around for a beer and let's talk about it. That's how simple it was. So there was no managers, no talk about money or anything. Yeah. But when I did the Terry Lamb book, I didn't know how to write a biography. I had no idea. So I actually went to a lovely guy called Alan Clarkson, a former journo. He'd just written Mal Meninga's book. So I went and got Mal Meninga's book, and I flat-planned my book along the same line, how many chapters, how many words per chapter. Yeah. So I think that was good to have those role models as a young writer. But everything was new, and we were really inventing it as we went along.
That's just great insights. It's fantastic. These names that you're bringing up, we've all seen them inside these books, you know, that have got, you know, brown pages now and dusty covers and everything. And all these names that are sitting inside these books, it's great listening to you. Yeah, can you just rewind a little bit and share, like, what inspired you initially
And how old were you when you decided that you might just give this a crack, or that you were interested in writing, to go even that far back? Yeah.
Well, like every kid, I think, that grew up in the 70s and late 60s, you know, I'm a bit older than you, and I was a fan of Tragic, but, you know, you start with the scrapbook, and I had scrapbooks all the way through, and it was really just cut and paste from newspapers, but it was a great way, you know, and I'm an educator, I have a master's degree in education, and one of the things I learned about education is that if you want kids to internalize passionately about a subject, get them to gather a lot of information and then reassemble it in their own way. And that's what I was doing as a kid. I was taking all the newspaper stuff, I was taking Ray Chesterton's stuff, I was taking Peter Frelingos' stuff, and I was, you know, cutting the photos out and writing my own copy and doing my own, you know, very fundamental stats lists and rugby league tables and building up these scrapbooks. So I think for me it was a real passion. And I think once I became a teenager, you know, I wanted to get into journalism, but I just wasn't able to, you know, there were so many hundreds of kids applying for cadetships, and being a Western Sydney kid, I always felt that we're a little bit, you know, just too far west to be involved in you know, the big hustle and bustle of Sydney.
Yeah.
So I went to Teachers College here in Penrith and got a scholarship to be a young teacher. But, you know, having spent 3 years of study and then 2 years at night to do a degree in teaching, you learn to write, you learn to put together arguments. So it was really just a transference of, you know, take those skills, apply it to rugby league. And it was really interesting because what we were doing, once we started publishing books about rugby league, we were actually intellectualizing and putting down on paper the history of the game. We were adding to the fabric of this history. And if you have a look at the history of rugby league, you know, there's very, very few books from, say, 1950s to 1980s even published. There was nothing in the 70s when I was a teenager growing up. Mm. So it was sort of like a brand new world. And the funny thing is, the magazine publisher that we got to do our first book, he got us to do it. Greg Anderson and I actually cut and pasted. These were the days when you had you know, you're in journalism, before computers, where you'd print off the sheets, you'd cut and paste them, and you'd glue them to the master set page, and then you'd take a photocopy of that. That's how you published in those days. So Greg and I just looked at each other and we said, hey, we're still doing scrapbooks. Here we are in our 20s doing scrapbooks. and that's what it was just a transference of skills. But it was good fun, except there was no money in it. We spent wasted a lot of time trying to do it, but yeah, it was still a brave new world for us.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, fantastic. And so by now you've written, I did a quick internet search, and you've written over 20 league books and 20 books on other subjects. Mm-hmm. But the one that still resonates with me personally is your Encyclopedia of Rugby League Players. I've got a few copies. I don't know how this has happened, but my dad probably picked up a few at some garage sales over the years. But I've got the one. It has Brad Fittler on the cover, Danny Farrar's on in the background, and there's a special tag that you've put across it. Revised edition includes special Queensland section. So is that for you your main contribution to the whole rugby league book canon?
I think my contribution, I think, is probably looking at, I don't see myself as an historian either. Don't like that idea that I'm an historian. Anyone with a library card's all of a sudden an historian.
Anyone with a blog is a journalist. Yeah.
That's right. Well, you know, I'm a writer. I'm a researcher. That's how I say it. I'm an observer. So with the Encyclopedia, that was really interesting. My publisher, Gary Allen, who published my Terry Lamb book and my Grand Finals book, he had a lot of success with the AFL stats book, and he showed it to me, and he said, this is a record of every first grade player. And I said, well, I'm not a statistician. I still don't do stats very well. You know, I just don't have that mindset. I love the story rather than the stat. And he said to me, can you do this? And I said, oh, not really. I said, I'm more of a writer than a statistician. I said, but let me see if I can find someone. And I suppose the premier statistician at the time was David Middleton. Yeah. David Middleton me. So he would have been, I was maybe 30, he was 20.
Yeah.
And I'd had a few dealings with David, and David is very, and rightly so, jealously guards his stats because that's his bread. That was, before computerisation and the internet, that was his bread and butter. He used to sell stats off to the clubs.
Yeah.
So I knew that he didn't want to be involved. So I came across a statistician in St Mary's who had done a couple of articles in the local paper, and he was building up even the defunct clubs, you know, Annandale and Glebe. He had spent months and months and months, a lovely fellow called Glenn Hudson, and he had gathered all this information over the years, and it was very much a work in progress. And so I said to him, how about we go halves in this? I'll do the biographies and you do the stats.
That's how it worked, eh?
And that's how it worked, and we went in. And the first book came out in 93, and okay, you know, we're in the pre-internet era, the pre-stats era. So we made lots and lots of mistakes.
Okay.
You know, the stats were very rubbery. We even left a couple of players out. I remember we had the big book launch, and we got a lot of press about it because nothing had been done like this before.
Yeah.
And they said, oh, what happens if there's a player missing? And I said, oh, well, we'll just have to fix it in the next edition. And the journo, I said to the journo, well, who's missing? He goes, Stephen Humphreys, the son of Humphreys, the former ARL head.
Kidding,
I went, oh, you're kidding me, you know. So it was, that's how easy it was for players to slip through. And there are a lot of phantom players, you know, Smith, who played in 1908, and Brown and Jones, and these were only phantom names, you know, players used to play under names. But we were the first, and I can take a lot of comfort in the fact that we were the first. And that actually went through about five editions, and each time we try to improve upon it, we put in country players, Queensland players, test players, but the stats were constantly changing. And I felt very guilty about this, because it made us look unprofessional that, you know, Jeff Gerrard, he's got 301 games, and then the next edition he's got 320 games, and then the next edition he's got 330 games.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, it's just too much of a minefield. And it wasn't until I got to know Ian Collis very well at Fox Sports that really they've only now nailed and totaled all these players. And I'm sure it would have been a lot easier to go with someone like David Middleton.
Mm.
But at least we build it up from the ground up. And the great advantage of that book, and why that book was so popular, was that everyone whose grandfather or father or brother or son were in that book, they bought a copy. So, you know, they wanted it on record. You know, his granddad playing for St George in the 1920s. So that was the beauty of that book. But I just wish the stats would have been a little bit more secure. But once again, it was the pre-internet years, and you know, we had to build it up from scratch. So we were the first to do that.
I wondered where you were going with the fact that you weren't interested in stats, but now it makes sense because there is a lot of bio information in that book. Did you have like a code to work? Like, was there a special sort of qualification criteria that meant a player got his own bio and somebody didn't? Like,
Yes and no. You know, obviously, if they were an Australian test player, they got a bio, a New South Wales player. They played in the grand final.
Yep.
But I had a couple of friends who knew I was a Penrith tragic, and they said, oh, there's a lot of Penrith bios in there. And I went, yeah, well, I know the players. And, you know, even my cousin, Rodney Whittaker, who played six games for Penrith in the 1980s, played in the front row. I gave him a little bio. he started off as a junior with Des Hasler in the centres at Cambridge Park, and I wrote that. But I think in subsequent editions, we had to be very careful. But one of the things that I was interested in writing about, and I'm still interested in doing this when I write about film or if I write about other things, especially long lists of things, is the economy of words.
Yep.
How can you tell a story? I've done this in true crime as well. How do you tell a very complex story in 1,000 words? Well, how do you get the essence of a player's career in 80 words?
Mm.
And that was a real skill that I had to try and develop. And how to get the essence of a player. And I remember writing the line, you know, for Graham Langland, said he was a flawed genius. And I thought, you know, that pretty much sums up his whole career. So it is quite a skill, and I really enjoy how can I get the words down and not lose anything.
Yeah.
And that was what I brought to that. But, you know, the stats were very rubbery, unfortunately. unfortunately.
Oh, okay. But now, like these days, I reckon, I mean, not being a stats person myself, I reckon that adds to the charm and the authenticity of the early works of keeping stats and keeping histories.
Yeah, I've still got a file of about 100 letters I got from, because we put in the back of the book, if you know any more information, contact the authors. So yeah. I've got a file here of 100 letters of former players saying, I didn't play 4 games, I played 27 games. Okay. I didn't play 8 games, I played 9 games.
Yeah,
and it was really funny. We had to, it was a lot of work. Like, I can't believe the amount of hours that we spent on those books.
Yeah.
But it was good fun at the time, but I wouldn't like to be doing it now. In fact, I've just published the A to Z of Rugby League,
yeah.
And I've got Ian Collis to do the stats, because he's the number one. He's the stats guru,
yep.
With Fox Sports. So, and look, even when he gave me his stats, I could spot a couple of mistakes and a couple of guys that I went to college with who played first grade rugby league. I was able to point him in the direction. So you never lose that skill to sort of be able to edit other people's work.
That's right. Yeah. Nothing wrong with your work. It's just that everybody else making mistakes.
Oh, you know what it's like when you're a writer. Yeah. You can't see your own mistakes, but you can always spot someone else and go, oh, "That's not right. I don't think that's correct."
That's right. I'm the sub editor here at Inside Sport, and it's amazing how clean my copy always is. It's incredible. just a few more questions here.
Sure.
I've always wondered. What advice somebody like you would have for wanting to, you're obsessed with rugby league, you're reading everybody else's books, what advice would you have for somebody who, is thinking about writing their own rugby league book, like to add to this?
To write it. The thing is now with publishing is, and because I'm a commissioning editor, I actually work in publishing now.
Okay.
And because I'm a rugby league writer, I get a lot of manuscripts.
Yep.
And I get a lot of ideas. You know, I had a lovely idea from a lot of retirees who are now looking for projects, and I do feel for them. And they, you know, I want to write a book on Australian rugby league players who served during World War One.
Yep.
And I think, well, that's a great. I want to read that book, but the realities of publishing is that it's probably going to sell 500 copies, and publishers aren't going to back it. So what you've got now is you've got publishing online.
Mm.
And you've got self-publishing or boutique publishing, where you can publish 500 and probably sell 500. But the worst thing that can happen to a publisher, a self-publisher, is to have 5,000 copies of a book that you've published and it's cost you $20,000 and they're sitting in your garage because you can't sell them. So the good thing is now is that there's a lot more avenue for you to publish your work. The second thing is that by all means, finish it, because the best way to get published, and I know this from my own experience, is to have a finished manuscript.
Is that right?
And if you've got a finished manuscript, that's the golden ticket to publishing. If you've got an idea in your head, go ahead and write it, because you've got to, you do it from a creative point of view. You know, the money comes second, always has for me.
Yeah.
The reality is, I feel for young journos and young writers who desperately want to take 6 months off and, want to write this book, but they've got mortgages and kids. And, I went through all that, and that's why I was a school teacher who wrote during the summer. It's very hard to support yourself doing that. But if you really want to write something and you're passionate about it, go ahead and do it, because even if no one else reads it, at least you've done the job. And now that we live in the internet, the post-internet age, everybody wants to know the behind the scenes. What was that story? What really happened there?
Mm.
And I've always found rugby league players, especially retired rugby league players, great subjects to have a chat with. They love talking, not from an ego point of view, but they love talking about their careers.
Yeah.
And it's very fascinating to listen to, and I've had the chance to interview all my heroes, Bobby McCarthy, Reg Gasnier, Royce Simmons, all those guys, I've had one-on-ones with. So go ahead and do it, because, you'll probably be surprised what you learn, and you might just get a really good book out of it.
Yeah, no, and as you say, that other people would want to read as well. Yeah, like us. And you mentioned what you're up to these days. And any other writing projects that maybe nobody else knows about, which bubbled off the surface? Yeah,
I'm just finishing Luke Lewis's biography.
Oh, nice.
board level about who we'd like to publish. And I said, you know, I've always admired Luke Lewis's career, and he was retiring, and I'm just actually physically writing it now. I just spoke to him on the phone this morning. And we've done all the interviews, and it's just a case of writing it up and getting it out for Christmas. That's out of season, but we just thought he was such a nice guy that we wanted to take a chance on it. And I think it's a good story. So, you know, you never lose that interest in talking to people about rugby league and maybe writing their story. And having ghosted a lot of biographies over the years, I did Matty Rogers's, I did Cliff Lyons, you know, I've done quite a few, done Roy Simmons's. I find it fascinating to sit there and ask questions and to write it in their voice. It's good fun. It's great discipline as a writer. But there are a lot of good stories out there. The problem with rugby league now is that everything's airbrushed, and whether or not we have the and media managed, whether or not we have the characters that are coming through. You know, we've got the Sam Fidays, and we've got a few other loose cannons. But whether or not we've got the real characters from yesteryear, I don't know. Yeah. But there's lots of good stories out there, so I encourage anyone who's got a passion for it to go and chase it, because it's great fun. Great fun meeting these people and also talking about their stories. Everybody's got a story, you just got to get it down on page.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I found what you said before was interesting about interviewing the older players who've retired. They tend to tell a lot better stories than the current young generation, don't they? I remember interviewing Kevin Campion for this podcast about 6 months ago, and I was asking him about his Adelaide Rams days, and how did you go there? Did you perform above expectations? And a modern player would say, oh, you know, we gave it a best shot, you know, good stead, blah, blah, blah. And he just came out and he said, oh, to tell you the truth, James, we were very poorly coached. So yeah. I can imagine somebody of the modern era saying that they were poorly coached. It'd be on the back page for 6 weeks, wouldn't it?
Well, that's why that's why it's good to talk to ex-players, because they don't really have a filter anymore. They can see a bit of perspective. You know, when you're in the eye of the storm, it's very hard to get a bit of perspective. And players are very guarded about, you know, even Luke's very guarded about bagging anyone. Not that he wants to bag anyone. He's not that sort of guy. You know, this isn't going to be one of those salacious tell-all biographies, because he's just not that sort of bloke.
Yeah, but, and you wouldn't expect that to come out of him, so you wouldn't buy that book expecting that.
No, it's really a celebration of what he was able to achieve.
Yeah.
And but I think the older players, they also worked, they also mixed with regular people.
Yeah.
You know, and I think they're a lot more down to earth. In saying that, I don't interview many of the current crop of players. Mm. And the ones that I have interviewed, I found to be very professional.
But,
you know, but I just think it's a different era where everything's sort of on the internet, and you know, there are no unknown stories anymore. So you've got to go out there and search for them.
Oh, terrific! And just finally, what about the modern game? Do you find yourself sitting down and watching it week to week and enjoying it and appreciating it?
I'm still a fan. Yep. It's not the game that I grew up watching. Mm. It's a different game. It's very fast. They're very athletic.
Yeah.
You know, watching the wingers dive into the corners, you know, that's just, you know, a different world from what I used to see, where people used to barge over under the posts.
Yeah.
And the athleticism of the players and the fitness is good, but I still don't like the demise of the scrum and the loss of the play of the ball. It's getting almost to touch football level. And I'd like to see it slow down a little bit and be more of a man-on-man contest. I hate the idea of the hit up where the forward hits the defensive line and four guys jump on his back. I don't see that as rugby league. What is the point of that? Where is the skill in that? And I know you've got to make your 10 metres and you've got to get to the advantage line. I understand all that. But the English game I'm a fan of because they spread the ball a lot earlier in the tackle count. They don't just do four hit ups, then a kick, then a spread, then a kick. So it is a different game. But, you know, I get a lot of enjoyment out of it. I'm still a Penrith tragic.
Yep.
I love watching the rugby league table from week to week. I still like looking at all the results. I've just bought the big league season in review, and I've just read the Penrith chapter. So, you know, all those things that we did as kids, it's very hard to sort of shrug off, even when you're almost 60 like I am. So, you know, it's a small small things that keep you amused, I think.
What's that saying? You don't really become an adult, you just learn to act like one?
Well, unfortunately, you know, John Lennon, whose birthday was yesterday, he said, you know, life's what gets in the way when you're busy making other plans. And I think that's the whole thing. You know, when I was a young writer, I was 30 years old, I had two little kids, and I was desperately trying to write and also pay my mortgage off and feed my kids and do all that stuff. And here I am now, 60, my kids are grown up, my son's just got married, he's 32. I've still got a little bit of a mortgage, but what am I going to do next year? I'm going to write more about rugby league, so nothing much changes.
No, that's right, and you hope it never does. Yeah.
No, it's those things. You know, I got told a long time ago, you know, find what gives you the most happiness, and then if you make that your day job, you know, you'll never have to work a day of your life. And even though I've left teaching and I've gone into publishing, I still love the joy of just sitting at my computer and writing, and I can write all day, and I can do that, you know, for 3 and 6 months at a time. And I think you've got to be that passionate about it to do it, and you've got to love it. You don't do it for the recognition or the money. None of those things have really come your way, but met a lot of really interesting people over the years and had a lot of fun, and I think that's just as important.
No, that's great, Alan. We'll wrap it up so you can keep on getting on with your writing life. I have a feeling when this goes out, we're going to be approached to have more of you on this podcast, because that was just it was amazing being on the other end of that chat and just to hear your story, and I'm sure that there's a lot more to it. So yeah, if with your permission, if I can harass you later on in the future,
The thing is, having been a school teacher most of my life, you know, school teachers love to talk. So, you know, but I think also if I can pass on, especially to young, like I know a lot of the young journos, you know, Andrew Ferguson, who runs the Rugby League Project website,
yep.
Young guys, you know, they ring me up for advice, and I've published Andrew Voss, and I've given him some advice over, you know, he's a very good writer, and, you know, he should do more books. But, you know, I'm happy to pass on what I've learned. But it won't make it much easier, but at least it'll give you a realistic outlook on what to expect.
Oh, yeah, well, you're basically what people want to become. To be able to sit there with a half a lifetime of work behind you is what a lot of writers aspire to, don't they? What a wonderful existence.
You know, there used to be an old adage that the only full-time writer in Australia was Bryce Courtney, and he's dead. So, you know, Bryce used to churn out a blockbuster every Christmas. You know, he used to have four writers do all the research for him, and he'd knit it together for the last 3 months, and he'd hit his delivery line, and he'd have $100,000 copy seller at the end of the year. But I don't want to be a machine like that. I just want to, you know, enjoy my projects and take it bit by bit. But you know, a lot of books that we did in